There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Today's guest is former Republican prisoner and provisional IRA member Dixie Elliott. The dairyman was just 19 years old, almost 20, when in 1977 he was sentenced to 12 years imprisonment for attempted murder, hijacking, and IRA membership. Whilst in prison, he shared cells with H Block hunger strikers Bobby Sands and Thomas McElwee, also provisional IRA members. Now 65 years old, the Republican says the years of violence were for nothing and that the IRA leadership should have ended its campaign of violence in 1987. Although a supporter of peace, he says the Good Friday Agreement is a scam. Dixie, you're very welcome on today's podcast.
Thank you, Patricia.
Why do you believe the Good Friday Agreement is a scam?
Well, I believe it's a scam because the terms of the Good Friday Agreement was always on the table. From what I know, that when the IRA leadership met the British and Sheeny Walk in London in July 1972, what they were offered was a troop withdrawal, an amnesty for all prisoners, and they says they couldn't give United Ireland, but if such a time came about, that when the majority wished it, that they wouldn't stand in the way. That was also on the Sunningdale Agreement in 1973. The Sunningdale Agreement was exactly the same as the Good Friday Agreement, only there was a Council of Ireland and the Sunningdale Agreement. Therefore, there was nothing negotiated, as we are told, and there was a reason why nothing was negotiated, because 1987, according to Adams himself, Hum and Fowler Reid went seeking peace, but they didn't tell the IRA. They approached Hoggy. Hoggy didn't want to be seen talking to Adams, so he used Hume as a go-between. And that was the start of Hume's Adams talks.
And that was Charlie Hoggy.
Hoggy, yeah. Now, while all this was going on, Hum and McGuinness continued to encourage war. People were dying. IRA volunteers were dying, civilians were dying, people were dying needlessly. They were dying in a war that the IRA leadership intended in at some point when the opportunity arose. And the thing was too, we often hear about McGuinness was a negotiator and stuff like that. The main players in the Sunningdale Agreement, or the Good Friday Agreement, was the SDLP and the Unionist Party. They were the big parties then. And the thing was that Sinn Féin wasn't allowed on the government until they abided by the demands of the British and the DUP, Paisley, decommissioning weapons, supporting the police and stuff like that there. So they hardly negotiated a settlement. You know, they accepted what was on the table and everything else, and they played along with it. And now we're told it was a great thing. But this could have happened back in 1873 when the same thing was on the table. So why did it continue all this time? Why did the war go on and stuff like this and all these people? a day. And as I say, that when they talk about the peace process is a scam for the simple reason that sectarianism is as bad as it ever was. It hasn't changed. The politicians use it to get elected, and they use it to distract people from their own failures. And that they have never changed nothing in 30 years for the ordinary people, especially the ordinary people in Derry. And it's nothing has changed except for them, as they've got richer, and the politics hasn't changed or anything else. They can't stand one another. But still, obviously, Sinn Féin saying they are now meeting and greeting the royal family to reach out for unionists, but the unionists still hit them as much as ever, which raises questions in my mind. Why they really, you know, I often starting to believe this could be something to do with the British Commonwealth.
The Good Friday Agreement is flawed, in your opinion, without a doubt, but it did end 30 years of violence here. Is that not one good thing that has come out of it?
Surely the 30 years of violence ended in 1994, the first ceasefire. Okay, the first ceasefire broke, but there was another 1997. There was another ceasefire, and that's been continuous ever since. So it ended then, like it was ended then. And but once they had set there, once Gerry Adams had set out to seek peace in 1987. And Adam McGuinness would have known about it, and thing me, that was the war ending. They knew the war was ending, so it was going to end then anyway. He was looking a way around it. He knew that there was people in the IRA wouldn't agree with it, and he had to carry them along until such the times was right, and that was costing people their lives. But it was going to end back there. It was always going to end. You know, from that time on, definite. They must have had it planned long before it. And I believe that they actually had ideas during the hunger strikes, when Bobby Sands won his election and Kieran Doherty and Paddy Agnew won seats in the South, that they decided, right, this is what we're going to do. But we have to take it slowly.
Dixie, take me back to the reason that you were sentenced to 12 years in prison. Attempted murder, hijacking, and IRA membership.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, the thing about that is very little to remember because we didn't recognise the courts. The courts became a battle. The Crumlin Road jail and the courthouse was at the far side of the Crumlin Road. There was a tunnel led from the Crumlin Road jail, still there to this day, across the courthouse. And we were taken across in that, and there was often battles. We refused to do things. We had protests and stuff like that. And we were, during the remand, we were brought before a judge. That was all, as far as we were concerned, was blah, 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 blah. We had no solicitors. We didn't recognise the court, so we didn't have solicitors. So it was us on our own. We were brought before the court, and we didn't listen to a word he says, and blah. And it was the same in my sense. I don't remember a thing about the day I was sentenced to 12 years in jail. We were defiant. We stood in front of the court and we let him blah, 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 blah. You're sentenced to 12 years. I was actually surprised. Like, I thought we got more, but 12 years was good. And, well, I thought, you know, and as I say, it was usually a 6-year no sentence, like half remission, but he ended up doing another 3 years on top of it.
What were the circumstances of those charges? What I mean, attempted murder, what had you done?
We should have probably fired shots at a Land Rover going down the Racecourse Road, and that was the attempted murder. Hijacking the van was just hijacking the van for operation and IRA membership. You see, I was arrested. My door was kicked in and I was arrested, and at the time, they were just waiting out. We all believe it was an informer stuff. We were getting all arrested and what done. You have to understand, we were only young kids, 19, we were pulled in. And at that time, we had the Castlereagh and the Strand Road Barracks and the Beatons and stuff like that. They call it the conveyor belt. And I was brought in, and over the weekend, I didn't say one word. I had it my depths, I got my depths out. We were taking a case recently, and the barrister says, you sat for 3 whole days, and you did not say a word, you didn't give your name, he says nothing, and it's all down there. And the next thing, on the Monday, you sign a statement. You don't give it, and you sign a statement, and then they ask you, and then you say you're saying nothing more, and you refuse to me. So, for no reason, you're not speaking to these guys for 3 days, and then for no reason, after 3 days, you just say, all right, I'm going to sign a statement. It doesn't make sense. Of course they give you a beating. Of course they get hammered. You know what I mean? And that's what happened. I had a ball patch in the side of my head where they dragged me along the floor back in with quite long hair. I had bruises on my chest where apparently I shouldn't have had bruises. Where I was punched, was held upside down, spread eagle. I was interrogated over the course by 6 branch men or CID men who took it in turns of 2 each at a time. When 2 was finished, they went in. That's the way it was done. They were there until they broke you. And I signed a statement that I didn't incriminate anybody else. It was just me. And after I signed, they started asking about others. And I says, no, I'm not saying nothing more. That's it.
Why did you sign the statement? Obviously, there was evidence against you that you...
No, there was no evidence. It was my own admission.
Why did you do that for?
Because, as it says, I was got a beating for over 3 days non-stop by 6 different and groups of 2. Thing, mate. No break. They were taking the breaks from the hidings. I wasn't getting the breaks. They were. And, of course, there's a lot of men broke on the system. And when I say broke, I just admitted to these 3 things. I've done a lot more things, but I admitted these 3 things.
And were you the gunman? And this is incident.
Yes.
You were the gunman.
Yes.
When did you first hold a gun?
Well, when we were taking the training camps in Donegal, we were given arm lights and shorts and stuff like that, and told they fire targets up in the mountains and away in the middle of nowhere. It was like an adventure. Do you know what I mean? It was, we were living out, camping out in the mountains at night and stuff like this, by a fire and stuff like that, or else when we were taken to ball making, it would have been like a cottage. I remember in a cottage somewhere. I don't know where it is, but I heard the waves outside. We were taken in the dark of night. Some wee cottage, and it was beside the sea, the Atlantic Ocean. You could hear the waves crashing up against the store. And we were up in an attic roof space and learning how to make bombs and stuff like that. But as I say, the best part was when you were learning the shit. I remember being at the base of Muckish Mountain and firing under the mountain. Probably that mountain is probably rubbed with bullets from IRA camps. You know, Muckish, the bottom of it, you know. I remember Muckish. And I remember another camp in the mountains around Letterman Award. I remember that there and going up under the mountain. We thought we were a flying column. We all these, you know what I mean? Up under the mountains, and you lived up in the mist, and you had to learn. But that's what we were taking away. Now, we were young guys. This was great. You know, you were going up, and we were firing real guns, real arm lights and stuff like that. You know, there was a bit of a thrill when you were doing that. Like, you know, there's no doubt about it and stuff like that.
For example, if you were going back then to this IRA training camp, there would be other boys or, you know.
Friends.
Yeah. And how many of you would be there?
Friends. All from the one area. We all knew one another. We're all friends. We all went to discos together. You know, we all stood around street corners together. You know, we're still friends, a lot of us. As I say, the guy was in the car. You know, because he was done time for it. The guy was in the care of young Michael Meenan, like when he was killed. He's been my friend since back then, my best friend since back then, you know. And all the other guys on here, you know, we were all, from when we were kids, we were friends. We're still friends. You know what I mean? We've lost a lot of friends along the way who died, but we lost a lot of friends who took the wrong path, as we believed, you know, followed Sinn Féin.
But when you were in these IRA training camps, I mean, were you a young teenager, or were you?
No, I was about, for anything from between 16 right up to was caught. They were ongoing things.
So there's a group of you there, and then you would be trained by older IRA men, basically.
Yeah.
And you'd be taught bomb making, shooting, and it was just like a big playground, basically.
Well, that's what it was. It was, you know what I mean? It was an adventure. I've heard of it triple, but it was an adventure. I remember sitting up in the mountains, watching the road below, and the lake across from the road, and, you know, you thought you were in Tom Barry's flying column, you know.
Did your parents have any idea of your involvement with the IRA?
Not really. My father, I remember one time going down the race course road in the back of the ferret. He would have climbed in the back of this is when, during riots. I would have climbed in the ferrets, a sort of small tank with a machine gun. And I would have climbed on the back of it when it was going slow with a ton of paint and painted out the hatch. But I was in the back of it and I picked up speed and I was stuck in the back of it going down the race course road. And I heard a car horn bumping behind me and I looked around, it was my dad. And I jumped off and my father says to me, no truer words that he said to me. He says, first of all, what were you doing in the back of that tank? And he says, what's going to happen to you is you're going to end up in jail or dead. And McGinnis is going to end up in a big house. That was his very words back then. And, you know, as I say, that would have been, he probably thought I was only riding and stuff. Because I'd actually, my father cried coming up to see me in buses and all, he couldn't believe it. You know, as I say, like, and my mother would have been too, but was my father took it the hardest. You know, he didn't really believe it. He knew it was riding because he knew all kids rioted at that age and stuff. We'd done all that. You know, he was young himself and he was a tearaway when he was young himself. He often told us that because he's smaller day when he was young. And, but I don't think he actually believed that I was a member of the IRA or anything like that, you know.
Dixie, do you have any regrets? I mean, you went out to kill. You were quite happy with killing someone.
I don't. Truth be told, you know, we would say that now, and there was a lot of guys would say, oh, no problem, man. You know, it's not easy to kill somebody. I've never killed anybody. But, you know, you'd sit there and say to yourself, oh, you know, would I have killed him? You know, would I have... If I had a shot that soldier in the back of a Land Rover, would I have been able to live with that? You know, I don't know, because I didn't shoot the soldier in the back of it. You know, and the back of a Land Rover and stuff like that. But I know guys who did. And guys who was very, you know, did a lot of killing and stuff like that. Many of them guys is alcoholics now. Their heads is messed up. They're good guys and stuff like that. And they can't accept it. They kill people for nothing, for absolutely nothing, and that the people that were sending them out is now grown rich, and they're travelling the world, and they're meeting politicians, and a lot of them, who like us, like I can't get into America or Australia, but there was guys who was in jail along with me, who can travel freely to America and Australia, you know, the politicians, and not only the politicians, it was... I noticed another boy saying he was just on his way back from Melbourne. You know, I wouldn't get onto Melbourne, but this guy was a blanket man. But he's now on the side of Sinn Féin, you know. So what's going on there? Like, that's not English.
You spent much of your adult life, or a good portion of it, in the H-box, and you were on the blanket protest, and you were in a cell with hunger strikers Thomas McElwee and Bobby Sands. I mean, back then, your feelings were completely different.
Yes.
Can you tell me what that was like then and what those feelings were?
Well, I strongly believed in what we were doing. I believe in the war. I believe it was a just war. I still do. I didn't regret anything. Or things, you know, it's just that now, as an old man, or an older man, that I see now that it was a waste. It was a waste of lives, it was a waste of the hunger strikers' lives, it was a waste of all the lives, the civilians' lives, stuff like that. It was a waste. We've gone from fighting a war, and the path that's been taken now is more or less the same path taken by SDLP. So therefore, what was it all about? And if I had known for one second when I was sitting in that cell, or when I was out in the street risking my life with a rifle as a 16, a 17, an 18-year-old, that I wouldn't have done it. I wouldn't have thrown stones for it. If I'd have known it was going to end like this, you know, it wasn't worth throwing a stone. But back then, we believed we were doing a stance to reason. Who would live in their own excrement? Who would take daily beatings and be starved and eat food that you knew was probably contaminated, you know, because there was times you were getting tea and you felt salty tasting it, and he says, you know, you knew what they were doing, like you knew you were urinating and that. But why would we put ourselves through that and suffer it and suffer the humiliation of mirror searches and forced washing and stuff like that? For, you know, I was on the blanket from when I was sentenced to the end of it. I was about 4 years and 6 months, I think, you know, about 4 years and 4 months. You know, why go through all that, all them years, you know, and we still believed it? And it's just that was the reasons we done it. And then we had these guys like Bobby Sands and Tom McElwee and other guys, you know, they kept each other going. It was amazing. The camaraderie was amazing. The way that people like Bobby Sands kept the morale up through stories, through songs and poetry and stuff like that there, you know, encouraging other guys to do likewise, and no matter how bad they were at it, you know, and speaking Irish, learning to speak Irish. The Hitch Blocks was a one big Gaeltacht. Even guys who had very little Irish still used it. No one, the Screws couldn't cope with us. They actually brought some guy from the south, and he wasn't very good. They tried to, you know what I mean? They interpreted what we were saying. But it was a privilege to be in a cell with Bobby Sands and Tom McElwee. They were different people, two totally different people. Bobby Sands was a thinker. He was somebody that inspired. He was a man who led from the front, like Brendan Hughes. He led from the front, and as he done on the hunger strikes, and he kept up the morale of the men through stories and stuff like that, and poetry, and simply as the fact that he was a guy that would never be broken. And Tom McElwee was a fighter, a hard man by heart, and he took no nonsense from anybody. When I was in the cell with him, we got more hidings and all off because he just used his fists all the time against the Screws and against the blanket early. He refused to give him a full cup of tea. He only half filled the cup, and Tom gave him a hiding. Then when he came back around to collect the dishes, and of course we got a hammer and flat and put on the boards and starved for a week. So it was a costly cup of tea, like, you know, I've never... It's probably why I drink coffee now. But as I say, like, he was a gentleman. And he was a great guy. He loved the country life, and he often talked about stories, told me stories. He told me he was engaged to get married and stuff like that at his time. And stuff like that. He was a hero worship Francis Cuse, who was his cousin. And as I say, before he went on hunger strike, before he left the wing, he gave me his rosary beads. I still have them to this day. I took them through the prison system and stuff like that, old wooden rosary beads. And he says, that's all I have to give you. But at the end of the day, he gave his life, you know. And I set another set, and we watched men like that walk under the wing for the last time, and they never came back, you know. And when we look at that, and we look at what's going on now, that even politicians, that is no different to what John Hume, or John Hume didn't lead people to their deaths. You know, they say they called the ceasefire, and then they called an end of the war, and then proclaimed themselves peacemakers. How can you proclaim yourself a peacemaker if you stop something you were encouraging for a generation? No. And ruin, no. completely ruined the lives of a generation and stuff like that. Like, okay, it wasn't just there, it was the British Army and stuff like that, but they encouraged a generation to fight a war. It's yet my generation who lost out in their youth and stuff like that. They encouraged that, and then when they ended all that, they proclaimed themselves as peacemakers. And as I say, I look back on that, and it's depressing, and it's the thing, man. And when you go online, we often go on the like Twitter, you know, when you get these young guys now, most of them's fake names, and they're saying to you about, oh, what do we do then? We continue the war. No, this seems to be a programmed response. Oh, why, you want to continue the war, blah, blah. Despite the fact that I've said numerous times that I'm opposed to the war or continuation of the war because of what happened in the past, because I've seen how we were led and people died. And these people became politicians, turning the world, being white and dying in the White House and everywhere else, while young men at 16 and 17 is lying up in the cemetery. And then you're going on there and you're being accused of wanting to continue the war, despite the fact that they're knowing it. And in our program response is, what's your alternative? But as a friend of mine says, how can you have an alternative to the lives that were squandered? There's no alternative for that. The alternative was always there, end the war.
So your issue then, Dixie, is that people, you believe, who died, their lives could have been saved because there was an opportunity to end that campaign of violence earlier and there was a chance for peace earlier. Though Sinn Féin and the former IRA leadership would say that's not true. You know, why have you formed that opinion?
Well, it's not that there was a chance of peace earlier. Adams admits himself, he admitted it at his brother's trial, Liam's trial, that him and Father Reid set out on the beginnings of the peace process. And we know that's when they approached Hockey and stuff like that. That was 1987. So we knew they probably had intentions long before then of ending it. And I believe that they intended to end it around the time of after the hunger strikes. And that's, it could have ended any time then. They could have ended when they realised that the war wasn't going to be a thing. What I always say was, the British Army didn't defeat the IRA. It was their own leadership undermined them. That's how they were defeated. And they were undermining them for a long, long time. And by Adams' own admission, 1987. Therefore, there was a potential to, they should have just turned around. It says the IRA, look, we can't win this war. We can't beat the Brits, and the Brits is not going to beat us. And it's going to go on and on and on. We need to find another alternative. And the other alternative, as far as I can see, is in the north, they took the path of the SDLP, and in the south, they're now sticking the same path as De Valera, only at a quicker pace. Therefore, this all could have happened any time in the past. They always put up as the unionists wouldn't accept this and stuff like this, and the British wouldn't. But you have to remember, they had to adhere to the unionists and British demands before they even got into government. The unions still don't accept them. To this day, they don't accept them. They hate them. So that's no excuse for not ending the war. Was that so? Because the unionists wouldn't accept them, or wouldn't accept the ceasefire and stuff like that. And then years later, 1994, they call it. And then the loyalists all follow suit. Although that's another scam, like the loyalists ceasefire and stuff like that. But this is what I'm saying. Like, these excuses, no, don't hold water. You know, you could have ended at any time. Along, and probably if they had ended it back then or in the 70s, we were probably closer to United Ireland today.
That's a big claim to make, Dixie. And I mean, obviously, you didn't feel this way when you were on the blanket during the hunger strikes. When then did you start to have these feelings that basically you were, I don't know, done over by the Republican leadership?
Well, When I got out of jail in May 1985, I joined Sinn Féin. I came out of jail with ideas. Ideas we talked about in jail, ideas we talked about during the blanket, about various things to help the people, change things for the life of the people. And I seen it for myself that there was no interest. The councillors were getting asked to go to Chantal and stuff like that, and they were laughing at me. There was no interest. They didn't want no interest to do this or anything else. And I just says to myself, no, that's not worth going back to jail for what I'm seeing, stuff like that. And I left Sinn Féin. I left the whole lot behind. We walked away. I met my wife, got married and stuff like that. But I walked away, you know, and stuff like this. But you have to realize at the same time that I walked away, little known to me and a lot of others, there was a thing called the Derry Project. Was set in motion, and was set in motion by two Quakers, and of course it couldn't happen without McGuinness, and it was winding down the wire and Derry to see how things goes, and it was noticeable that very few things was happening in the city around that time, about the 86, 87 and on up, it was noticeable that was happening. But, and then we found out in later years, of course, Declan Kearney and others was sent over to America to wind down Norwood. No, so this was all, the whole thing towards the peace process was getting set in motion. You know, but as I say, I didn't know about the Derry experiment and I didn't know about this and that. But the fact was, when this was going on, there were still guys dying. Guys carrying bombs and stuff like that. They were still dying on the streets and people were still getting killed on the streets, while Labour were preparing the way for the slow path to peace. The war was going on through the rest of the North. So what I often look back and say to myself now, if I had, and I look back at the guys who died back then, and I say to myself, well, if I had stayed, I could have been dead. Couldn't be, I mightn't have made it this far. Could have been dead. And what for? Nothing. And as I say, you know, therefore, it was good, it was the best decision I ever made. Or else I would have been back in jail, that too. But the death part was, when I look back and I said I could have been killed, hurt, or dead, you know.
So when you came out of prison in 1995, you were prepared to go back into violence and carry out violence?
Well, I was prepared for the war, you know. But the fact of the matter was that, you know, I didn't see it going anywhere. The war or stuff like that, and with ideas and stuff like that. But then I just decided within a short space of time, no, I wasn't, and I left. You know, you would have people saying, so you left the war in 1986 or whatever, you know. You haven't pumped the guys. One guy in particular was using this and they cut it out like it was, the guy's very rich now. Owns a lot of property and stuff like this, you know. And he didn't do much himself, although he was in the IRA, you know. But this is the fact of the matter. You have to understand, there was a lot of guys in the IRA who didn't do anything. You know, they led, but they led from a safe distance. You know, so this was another thing too. You know, there was guys who led from a safe distance. They are now, a lot of them is now very rich landlords and stuff like that, own bars and stuff like that, while the guys who actually fought died young. And that was going right back, I noticed that right back in my youth, as the 16 and 17 year olds, the guys recruited us in the IRA that was sending us out, even the 16 year olds with bombs and stuff like that there and rifles. They'd never done anything. A lot of them never went to jail. A lot of them were still there when we got out of jail. You know, this is the thing too. And meanwhile, young men and women was dying under the so-called leadership of people like us, OCs and stuff like this. And one guy, a very close friend of mine's, after we had all went into jail in 1976, the half of Chantal was wiped out. He was one of the few remaining. And he says what he remarked at the time. He couldn't believe there were so many IRA volunteers he knew he didn't know about in Chantala, because most of them was in intelligence. Now, what intelligence was guys who joined IRA just to be able to say they were an IRA. They didn't do nothing, but he says, oh, we are on intelligence. So we had a massive intelligence. Low half of them wasn't even intelligent, he says. You know, they weren't smart. But there was a lot of guys to join like that, you know, to be able to say I was an IRA. But they didn't do anything. They just says, oh, we're intelligence and stuff like that.
So take me on your own journey, Dixie, into violent republicanism. You know, what age were you when you became involved with the Provisional IRA?
I was about 16. That's for most people my age. I got involved when we lived in the old Rosemount, the old terrace streets at the top of the hill on Craigan Hill. There was a police barracks two streets away. And of course, it was attacked in 1969. It was attacked again in 1970 when the British Army occupied it. And I always remember that growing up, that our street actually became the outer defences of Rosemount Barracks. They built a sandbag post at the bottom of the street and they built a sandbag post at the top. Therefore, if you had to get out, you had to go through the sandbag posts to get out. And as I say, there was always rioting. I remember firing stones at the sandbag post at the top of the street and going in through the sandbag post at the bottom of the street to get into my house. You know, this is from when we were young kids, like, you know, 15, 14 kids. Then one day there was a bomb at the street, the Sanger at the bottom of the street, and there was the British soldiers and the Bowling Green was killed. And half the roof was blown off our house. And this was the house that my generation of my family, and going right back to my great grandparents, had lived on. Or the street, actually, the street they had lived on. So we had to leave. Now, our neighbours, my father was a Protestant, he was a Presbyterian. My favourite uncle, my uncle Ernie, was a Presbyterian. And my grandfather, of course, he was a Presbyterian. I was born in England. My mother went to England in the 50s with my father. I've never thanked me, but I always believe that it's because my granny, her mother, didn't want her marrying a Protestant, so they cleared off to England. And my mother would never admit it, but that's what I've been told. You know, that, and then she came back, we came back and we left from my granda, the father, they came back to Derry. And because I was named after him, Tom, you know, that we were very close. And my grandfather was wounded in World War One in France. And that's the first death I remember in my life, you know, and I still remember my granda dying this day. And but as I say, our neighbours was half and half. They were Protestants, Catholics. We played football in Brook Park with Protestants. We went out to the walks in the field because you had nothing else to do then. That's why there was very few fat people back then. You know, we walked miles and miles to the fields out to Greenan and stuff like that. And it was all, I remember one day going out to Greenan and a police car pulled up. It was a whole crowd. It must have been about 20. And
when you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Policeman looked out. Now you see, man, and he says, "Where are you going, son?" And he says, "I'm going up there." Greenland, you know, but this was at this young lad was a RUC man's son. This was back in the '60s. The Protestants and Catholics, we played football together. We grew up. We were very close, and that all ended 1969. Now, what my father always says, my father always told us a story. He always says there was two bands in Rosemount. There was the AOH band and the Orange band. They all drank together in Gregory O'Kane's bar. They shared instruments, and they were friends. His friends was all Catholics and Protestants and vice versa. After the 12th, they came in, and there was a bit of banter and stuff like that. There was no sectarian hatred and stuff like that, and he blamed Paisley. He says none of that was happened. The Paisley came along, and he always blamed Paisley for it. And, of course, when we moved in after the bomb and stuff like that, we moved to Cairn Hill, a housing estate. And it broke our hearts. But that's then when I became involved. Firstly, writing and stuff like that. And these guys took me aside and says, "You're not a feared or stuff, fearless and stuff like that." And I was a young guy. I was impressed with this. These guys, as the IRA. No, they're telling me I'm feared. And I was recruited on the IRA.
So what an interesting background, Dixie, that you came from a mixed family. Your father was a Presbyterian, but still you ended up joining the IRA.
You have to understand at the time that the British Army was attacking, raiding homes and beating us up, and we're getting harassed as young people by the British Army. And the RUC was far worse. You know, to be, people would say, "Oh, we understood." Like, I was only a kid. We didn't understand about gerrymandering. We didn't even know what it was or anything like that. But it was happening. Our parents didn't know what was happening. And I almost have to say this, like, my father was a Protestant, his family were Protestant. Our house was no different to the Catholic houses. We had no different. We brought up hand to mouth and stuff like that there. No, we were no different. And the other Protestants in the street were no different. They were led to believe that they were better than us. That was the only thing. They were told they were better than us. They believed they were better than us, but they weren't. We were all the same deep down. No, that's one of the reasons now I don't have no time for religion, because of, you know, that's what's divided us. But I, at the time, it was that we were getting harassed. The British Army was in our streets. It was our streets. It was our home and stuff like that. They were kicking on, literally, they were kicking on our doors, you know, and we believed they had no right to be there at the time and stuff like that there. And they still have no right to be here. But what I'm saying is, there was also a Protestant volunteer in Shantala, Davy Russell, who was killed carrying a bomb, along with an artist. He was carrying a bomb. He was a Protestant. He lived just in Steelstown, which would have been a middle class area above Shantala. But the fact was, he was going on to Shantala, and he was running around guys. It's just where we were brought up. We happened to be brought up there, and this was it. We were experiencing all this and stuff like this. You know, maybe we would have become from middle class or upper class areas. I don't know. We might have been better or something. But this was it. We were working class kids and stuff like that. And a large part that as I say, and there was always the thing that these people was exploiting us. These people wasn't willing to do this themselves. Oh, we were often told, oh, I done my part, now it's your turn. You know, this was the oldest one in the book. You know, this is your turn. But as I say, I believe that violence was the only way then, that it was the only way to achieve anything, and it was the only thing. But sure, it didn't work.
Do you believe that there was an alternative to violence? Because this week in the news, we've heard that some Sinn Féin leaders have said there was no alternative. What's your belief?
Well, you see, Sinn Féin will be saying that this week, and they'll be saying something different, you know. The thing is, back then, I believe there was no alternative to the violence. That was, as I say, the British Army came on our streets. The Catholic people was battened off the streets because they demanded civil rights and everything else. And they were beaten off the streets. And after the Battle of Bogside, they sent on the British Army. The British Army came from England. They came from England, and they were a foreign force. They turned their guns. I think it was Bernadette Devlin says that. How could they be here to keep us apart if their guns is facing us? You know, their guns was facing under the Bogside when they landed, not anywhere else. And it was always Catholic doors getting kicked in and things like that, and raided and stuff. Those and Protestant doors and stuff like that there. You know, Catholics was nationalists and all, and Republicans was getting in there and stuff like this. So this was a foreign, as we say, a foreign occupier. And that's why I believed in the war, and I believed in that. But now looking back on seeing that the people who encouraged the war and who led the war didn't really believe in it. You know, it was an opportunity, and it was a way into a better politics and stuff like that. But they used it. It's always happened in Ireland. You had it with Devil Air and ones like that there. It's always happened, and it'll continue to happen, and it'll continue to go on. So they say, was there an alternative? Back then, no. They came onto our streets, they came onto our towns and cities from England, and they kicked on our doors, and they shot people dead on Bully Sunday on our streets. And therefore, we believed people that was protesting peacefully. So that's why I believe there was no alternative back then. But now, as I say, the IRA leadership, and it did, I don't know, but it must be before 1987, around that time, decided that there was an alternative, and they took that path. So it should have ended then. That's my point, you know. And for them, as they say now, there was no alternative, they'll say something different next week. The week after.
So, Dixie, you became involved with the IRA as a teenager. When did you carry out your first operation or job or whatever you want to call it? What was the first thing that you were asked to do officially by the IRA?
Well, we started out keeping watch. We called it stagging. You stand on the street corner, you stand on an alleyway or stuff like that at different points in the housing estate. You watch for an army foot patrol coming. Well, IRA volunteers would have been out operating or ready to sniper attack or bomb or something like that. That was one of the first, these were the first things you done, scouting. No scouting away and watching for the army, and you blew a whistle if you seen them. And running and stuff like that there was one of the first. But the first thing that I remember was going to, I suppose it was childhood, like, but going, getting sent down with incendiary devices to burn a bus depot, burn all the buses. We were young kids then, 16-year-olds. We were sent down to burn a bus depot, you know.
So you were sent with bombs?
Yeah, incendiary devices.
And did you have no fear?
No, you don't have fear at that age. This was the thing. You don't You think you're indestructible at that age. You don't realize. You know, now if I thought my son was doing that, I'd be terrified. You know, I would. You'd be terrified. You know, you do a lot of mad things, but you know, when you're that age, you do crazy things. Like, I remember walking along steel girders on a building site. They were building a factory, and I was walking along the steel girders. Like, I wouldn't even climb the top of that thing. You know, you don't think you're going to die. You don't believe you're going to die at that age. You believe you're struggling. And it was the same when we were in the IRA. We didn't, you know. And we were running around with rifles and say, shorts and carrying bombs and stuff like that there. You don't think that you're going to, even though you see young guys, which happened, getting blown up and stuff, you don't think it's going to happen to you.
And your friend did die whilst transporting a bomb?
Ben Meenan, yes. Another friend of mine's was actually, he was 17, he was driving the car. He was behind the steering wheel when the bomb went off. He's a member of this group, he'd done time for it, so he served time for it, so it's not telling anything at his school. He was behind the steering wheel, it went off, there was a flash, and he came around. And he seen the flashing blue lights and stuff in the distance. And he looked behind him, and there was the back of the car was a mangle, tangled mess of metal. He got his way out of the car, and he actually walked past the army and all was coming up the thing. He calmly walked past them, half his face hanging off. And he was taken over the border. He was 17. And I remember that night as well. It was around Halloween. It was dark. When Jerry Craig and Davy Russell died, it was a beautiful, fantastic summer's day. They actually showed me the photographs of their body in the barracks, a headline under the car. There was actually a child in Bram, was nearby. It was a miracle that no one wasn't killed. But these things stick with you, you know, and when you go on and then you see other young people, like my Bronco Bradley was shot in the back of the British Army. He was in the blanket, and he got out and back the IRA. And you look back and you see, you know, you see many people young that died along the way, and here I am now telling my story. I'm 65. You know, I made it this far. These guys didn't, some of them didn't get out of their 20s, under their 20s.
You referenced the group there, Dixie, and for anyone who's listening or watching, particularly if you're watching, we are in the Ex-Prisoners Outreach Programme Centre, which is in William Street in Derry. In the background there, we have
a replica,
if you want to describe it there, Dixie. And this centre, I've been in it a few times, speaking to different prisoners and yourself, and I notice that a lot of people, tourists particularly, come in here, and there is a lot of Republican regalia, things from the prisons, and there is ex-prisoners here to talk to. I know I'm kind of jumping forward, but we're talking about the centre. You talked a lot about trauma there, that maybe didn't seem like trauma when you were a teenager. You know, when you're sitting here talking to other prisoners, are you realizing that you are suffering trauma in any way?
Well, for a long time after I got out, 19, I didn't really suffer from trauma. I took about a week getting used to the crossing the streets and crowds of people, but eventually I got used to it. But I didn't suffer for a long while. What was actually happened was that when Richard O'Raw brought out his book, Blanket Men.
And Richard's a former IRA prisoner as well.
And he was a PRO during the blanket. He was actually Bick McFarlane's advisor. Bick didn't do nothing without getting advice from Richard. And when he brought out that book, I was in the cell with Richard, or in the wing with Richard. I was in the wing that time of Bobby Sands and Bick McFarland and the others. And when he brought the book out, and he says that the British had made an offer on or about the 5th of July, 1981, and they had looked at the offer coming back, and they had accepted it, and sent word outside that they were accepting the offer to end the hunger strike, and that Adams sent word back in and didn't go far enough. Then, having been on the wing, me and others I spoke to realised, do you remember word went round the wing? The Brits were moving and Joe McDonald's not going to help today. And then nothing more happened. We all realised this is what was happening. And guys actually came out, that was up in the cells beside Bick and Richard, and says that's what happened. The two of them agreed out the window, an Irish, that there was enough there to end it, and they sent word out. That was traumatic, given that I had known Bobby and Tom McElwee. I sent the cell with him. Like, you know, when you're living in a cell in your own excrement for that length of time, I was in a cell with Bobby for 3 months, and I was in a cell with Tom for about 7 months. You know, that's a long time when you're don't get out of yourself for 24 hours a day and you're living your own excrement and stuff like that. You know each other like brothers. You know everything about each other. You tell each other stories. And that's the only way to pass it out. And we had watched these men go out of the wing for the last time and not be returned. And when I realised what they had gone through on the hunger strike, a long drawn out hunger strike, starving, and their families pleading them not to die, to come off it and stuff like that, watching their mother and their father and their aunts. You know, I didn't go on the hunger, I didn't put my name because I knew I couldn't do it. I couldn't put my family through that. I couldn't put my mother through that. Couldn't break her heart. Slowly break her heart. You know, long drawn out. And these guys done this. They walked and they decided like that they were going to die in a hunger strike, and their family suffered too. We forget that. Their family suffered great. And at the end of the day, after 4 deaths, Thatcher was bit. She had come and she had made an offer which included her own clothes, not as a privilege, as a right. That was on it. Not as a privilege, as a right. And that was always, we've always believed, and I remember going right back to when we were in H6 on the leadership wing, and I remember being told that's what they were actually, the dark was discussing when a well-known member of the blanket, that a leading IRA man left the protest, that had nearly wrecked the blanket. Guys were saying, if he can leave, I'm not going to name his name, he's dangling, but if he can leave, we can leave. This guy was up there along with Bick and Bobby Sands and guys like this. We can leave. And the guys was going. You couldn't blame them. I don't blame them. We were going through. But the dark says, look, if this keeps going, I guess we end up with 100 men in the corner of the thing, mate, and the hitch blocks, and forgot about it. So they talked about then in 1979. About going on the system and wrecking it, and the only thing that stopped it was the prison uniform. We simply couldn't wear it. Therefore, if we had got our own clothes at any time, the protest would have ended. And Thatcher was about the 5th of July, and one of the things was our own clothes at all times. We actually got, when the hunger strike ended on the 3rd of October, 1981, 3 days later, we got what they had offered. 3 days later, Pryor had given us what had been offered back at that date. You know, so, as I say, this played a lot on my, you know, mind and stuff like this, and it still plays in my mind. It makes me very angry and everything else. And now I'm seeing people saying, this seems to be a thing now, that the sacrifices of the hunger strike left us where we are today, brought us to where we are today. Nobody would have died for that. I wouldn't have thrown stones for it. And I'm certain that men wouldn't have died in hunger strike and put their families through that for what John Hume had already been doing long before that.
Some of the people who died during the hunger strikes Bobby Sands, Tom McElwee, all Provisional IRA members like yourself, they were your closest friends. I think you even said there that they were closer than a brother because you were sharing a cell with these people. Did you actually believe that when they went on hunger strike that they were going to die, or did you believe that the British government would have given?
I believe the British government would have given in, especially after maybe two deaths or whatever. You know, I believe that, I always believed that they were giving in. But then the longer it went on, you were starting to say, it doesn't look as this is going to be a long drawn out. You know, this is not going to end. It's never going to end. And stuff like that. But Bobby Sands went on that hunger strike. He went on first because he knew he was going to die. He made Francis Cuse second because he knew he was definitely die. Because effectively what happened during the first hunger strike was, and despite what people's trying to spin it and stuff like that, the first hunger strike ended because three men told the Dark they were coming off it. The Dark had promised Sean McKinney wouldn't let him die. Sean was going into a coma. And these key guys in the Dark says, I'm not going to watch Sean McKenna die and then watch the hunger strike fall apart. We all knew that, spoken to hunger. I thought it was amazing that things when they heard this, seen a document. They seen the document and the Dark ended it. Lawrence McKeown lied when he says that the Dark says, Bobby, says the Dark fucked up. That was a lie, Bobby says it was the first hunger strike was a fuck up because there was men on it, wasn't willing to die. And I want to put that record straight because it's been spun and spun and spun. And there's men out there, and I've spoken to former blanket men, and men was on the wing. We all know that's what happens during that first hunger strike. As for accepting an offer or a document, Adams wrote himself in his there, a document, a temptation, that Fowler Meagher got the document at Belfast Airport. He brought it to Adams in a house in Belfast. And while Adams was looking at the document, Tom Hartley bust in and says the hunger strike was over. Therefore, Adams was looking at the document, and there was nothing in the document. The document merely says, around a lot of waffle and everything else, it merely says that all prisoners could wear civilian-type clothing during the working week. He didn't renege on that. They gave it in and was thrown back at him. It was not a form of prison uniform. You know, and I for years I ignored all this, but then when Adams and all are starting blaming and McKeown started blaming the Dark and stuff like this, I says, no, I'm not gonna allow this to happen. I'm gonna say how it happened and how others know it happened.
The Dark is Brendan Hughes.
Yes.
Who you refer to.
Yeah.
He was another close friend of yours.
Well, I wouldn't say the Dark would have been a close friend. Now, I was on the wing with him since we moved to H6 in February 1979 until he went on the first hunger strike. The Dark was a man we all admired. He was a guy who led from the front at all times. He was a legendary figure in the IRA. He was older than the rest of us. And he had always, inside and out, was a man who didn't ask others to do what he wasn't willing to do himself, unlike people who claimed that they were never in the IRA. You know, they might as well have not been in the IRA, from what I'm told. But what I'm saying is, the Dark wasn't like that. The Dark, and he was highly respected. He was up there during the blanket protest. It was him and Bobby Sands. They were the two guys we respected, because they were the guys that led from the front, you know.
I know you've talked a lot about Bobby Sands during this interview, and you spent a lot of time with him. I mean, what type of person was he?
Bobby Sands was the thinker, and he was a teacher. He was a storyteller, and he was a Gaelgor. He was a lot of things for one person. He was a very talented singer. A lot of people have say he sounded like Ross Stewart. I always know I don't like the man. I think he sung like Bono, you know. And he had a love for all types of music, from the Beatles to traditional music and Gaelic and stuff like that. It was thing-made, you know. And as I say, he believed in keeping men's minds occupied. He had seemed to have this thing about books that he read. He could remember them. And in a lot of cases, he added to them, made parts up to extend them, and he would serialize these books out the door. And you had The Licks of Trinity by Leon Uris, and his most famous book, Jet. In later years, I tried to find this book, Jet, and I couldn't find it. And Dennis O'Hearn, who wrote his autobiography, talked about it, and he says they couldn't find it, as the other blanket man says. So we came to believe that Bobby made this story up himself. And Jet was the story. Jet was the initials. This guy was called Jeremiah Eisenhower Turnbull. His father was a three-star general, and he had to go to Vietnam. He was a conscientious objector, so he faked his own death and came back and hit the roads in America on a Harley. And it was a fantastic story. It kept everybody going and stuff like that. There was no Republican element there or anything like that. It was a lovely story. And everybody loved it, you know. And it was things like this, and he could tell our stories. His poetry was amazing. His singing, and as I say, like that. And he encouraged speaking the Irish language, teaching it and speaking it at all times. The blocks was like, and you were learning Irish language, and you were writing on the wall, I guess. Was writing it down, and you were memorizing it and stuff. Sometimes we would have used the corner of the metal part of the rosary piece to write if you hadn't got the wee pencils or stuff that was smuggled in. You know, you wrote out and the Irish, and you memorized it, and then you rubbed it off and stuff like that. Of course, when you move sails or in a wing shift, it would have been gone when you come back. It would have been blasted off the wall. But this is how we learned, and we learned speaking it and making up stories and stuff like this. Bobby encouraged all this. Bobby knew that the thing to do was to keep men's minds occupied at all times.
What was the blanket protest like? How many years did you spend on it, Dixie? And for anyone who's listening to this podcast and doesn't know what the blanket protest was, could you explain it?
Well, the blanket protest came about because of the attempt to criminalise the Republican struggle, that in March 1976, Roy Mason decided that prisoners were no longer political. There was guys still in the cages and long case, because they came in before that date, or if you had been charged before that date, at a later time, you went to the cages. But a few were charged after that did, you were a criminal, a common criminal. You had to wear the prison uniform and do prison work. And when I came in September 1976, Kieran Nugent had started the blanket protest. He had refused to wear that. He was the first blanket man. And they gave him a prison uniform, which was like denim, dark denims and stuff like that. And he had says to me, and he didn't nail it to me back. And they gave him a blanket and the towel, and they put the blanket around him, and he became the first blanket man. And it was a protest against the criminalisation. We weren't going to accept the tag as criminals, or we weren't going to wear a prison uniform. And Kieran Nugent started, and he was slowly followed by other guys who went on after him, and then it became about 300, maybe at a time 350 men. I don't think it went much beyond that, you know, but that's how it became, because we had nothing else to wear, only this blanket. The blanket was covered us at night, but during the day it also covered us. And it got to the stage during the protest, when we started out, we were in a metal bed with a sponge mattress, with a locker and stuff like that. But as the beatings and the hammerings and everything continued, and especially when the dark came up from the cages and joined the protest, we escalated it, smashed the windows, smashed the furniture, and we were left with sponge mattresses, sleeping on the floor. on sponge mattress. And the thing about lying on a concrete floor on a sponge mattress is condensation. And it meant at night when you get up the next morning, you had to put them up against the wall to try and dry them out. The only thing that saved us was the heating pipes. Two heating pipes were running along the wall below the window. And these mattresses, as I say, became rather wet. But that was what we existed on. You know, sometimes you wonder how we done it.
And the blanket protest turned into the dirty protest.
Well, we wouldn't call it the dirty protest, the no wise protest, you know. As we would, no others call it dirty, but we don't call it, we call it the no wise protest, you know. Because that's what it was. We refused to wash, refused to clean. And then we started putting this treatment on the walls, you know.
I mean, when you were asked to do that, did you feel disgusted? What did you feel like?
Naturally, you know, you have to imagine yourself, like, when doing this, like, you naturally felt disgusted and stuff like that. But we also believe that the screws couldn't cope with us. They couldn't cope with the smell. They couldn't cope with having to go on these cells like that. You know, I would deter them and stuff like that. But like us, they eventually got used to it too. You know, when they would come along, we're like, see, they began to fire a very strong bleach under the cells and stuff. And this was really affecting guys. You know, there was a lot of horrific things went on. They stuck hoses on the door and left guys standing all night on puddles of water in the freezing cold nights. You know, they were doing things like that to try and break us. You know, whereas we thought that putting their own excrement in the walls, you know, this would hasten the end of the protest. And therefore, you get used to it. It's amazing when you get used to it. People can get used to anything, living on a concrete box day after day in your own excrement. You can get used to that. It becomes commonplace, you know.
And could you get used to the maggots crawling over you?
Yes, you get used to them too. We got used to the maggots. We started to feed them the birds. You know, it was a form of entertainment, feeding the maggots to the birds. But it was, at the start, disgusting when you seen all this. See, the rotten food that we didn't eat was thrown on the corner and that began to pile up and then the maggots began to come out of it.
So how long did you do the protest for?
I went on the protest after it was sentenced in June 1977 and I stayed on it until it ended after the hunger strike in October 1981, about 4 years and 4 months.
Wow.
You know, there was guys on it a lot longer than that, you know, and there was guys, you know, coming and going, you know, but that was, I ended up serving 9 years out of a 12-year sentence, but then it was half remission. No, so I've done an extra 3 years in jail. All the other guys done the same, like done extra time because of the protests and other things.
Do you still consider yourself a Republican?
I'll be buried Republican. The day I die, I'll be Republican. I believe I've known Republican, although I don't believe that armed struggle or any sort of way will achieve anything. Now, especially with technology and all that they have now, it's impossible. But even back there, when we seen how strong the ARA was, how big it was, with the memberships even and Derry and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, what we are now realising was that the ARA was heavily infiltrated with informers. We know that now and stuff like that. So what would it be like now? These guys don't even need informers now. They can sit miles away and listen to you talking. And they can turn off the TV. And unbeknown to you, they can tune down the TV. So you're not going to defeat that there, these guys. But I'm a Republican. I'll always want a united Ireland and a better life and stuff like that. I didn't waste half of my life. But I don't believe that an armed struggle or anything else is ever going to achieve it, never.
What's your opinion on so-called dissident Republicans? I know more recently, after the murder of Lara McKee, that there's been a crackdown, and that came from MI5. What's your view on those Republicans who still feel there is a need for a war and violence?
Well, there's no war. Let's be friendly. That's not a war. That's a joke. The only person that they've killed was Laura McKee. The young girl was starting out in life, a journalist. She sat on here with us for a full day and was enthusiastic about what was in front of her, talking to old men and listening to their stories, the same way you're doing. And 2 weeks later, we get Ashlyn and Craigham. Dead. I get very angry. We all got very angry on here. We got very angry. And what was it for? The wee girl's dead. Nothing's been achieved. They've achieved nothing. They don't know. And I believe that the intelligence agencies is happy to let it go on and happy to let they arrest people, certain people, they arrest certain people and let certain people go because of funding. It justifies their funding and everything else, and it's an acceptable level of violence, but there is nothing happening except for the odd kneecaps and whatever else and stuff like that. You know, that's not a war. It's nowhere near a war. And stuff like that. So the only people's benefits in MI5 and then the likes of Sinn Féin can say, look, our peace process, blah, blah, blah. And I've scissored them often enough that Sinn Féin simply point to you and say, these people here, stuff like that there. But there's nothing really happening in terms of a war. So the best thing they could do is end it. Put the guns away or do whatever and end it. Because as far as I know from, I can't speak for everybody, but a lot of old Republicans are saying the same, that it's not going anywhere, it's a joke, and that they should just end it and take a more community-based approach to getting the support of people and stuff like that without the need for violence. Or...
Last question, Dixie. Do you believe that there'll ever be a united Ireland?
Oh, I believe there will. I believe more so now because of Brexit. I believe Brexit's brought us closer to the united Ireland than Sinn Féin ever has. And strangely enough, Sinn Féin strongly opposed in recent years because of funding. You know, they always opposed the EU, but when they realised they were going to lose their funding, they supported it. But the fact of the matter is, and we're seeing it with a protocol and stuff like this, and the Brexit is going to bring us closer to united Ireland because simply because of the fact that business interests, and we're seeing it despite what the unions are saying, that there's been a lot of increases in profit and north-south and stuff like this and everything else because of Brexit. And I believe it's at the same time that the British no longer wants the shackle of the North around their necks. And I've seen a recent survey where I think it was 47% of the people in England says that the UK should be broken up. And that's, you know, I think it's in the near future that this is going to happen, that is going to be broken up. But I sort of question, you know, what is going on? Is Sinn Féin and the British, because of recent statements they've made and because of where they are with the royal family and stuff, are they going along the lines of the united Ireland within the British Commonwealth? Mary Lou has said only a couple of years ago that the British Commonwealth should be on the table. Chris Donnelly has said that the Republicans have often spoke about joining the British thing. And don't forget, Alex Maskey is the president of the Stormont Commonwealth Committee, as was Mitchell McLaughlin, you know. That was the whole thing. So I believe that all this falling over, I believe this is where this could be leading, that a united Ireland within the British Commonwealth.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.